It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It has long been known that high blood pressure, also known as hypertension, is more prevalent in the African-American community. Known as the silent killer, it has taken the lives of over 50,000 people in the last year alone. High blood pressure can lead to heart disease. Here in Allegheny County, African-Americans have higher death rates than those of the rest of the state and other ethnic groups. How can this trend be reversed? Allegheny General Hospital cardiologist Dr. Indu Purnima joined me in Studio A to talk about her study that discovered the prevalence of hypertension in Black Americans. We asked her to give an overview of the study and explain possible reasons why this trend has emerged.
So we now know that African Americans clearly have a higher proportion of high blood pressure compared to whites. It's close to 40% of the African Americans living in the United States have high blood pressure, both men as well as women, as opposed to 30% in most of the other races. So it's not clear exactly what these reasons are, but it's probably multifactorial. Some of this is clear physiological reasons, such as a genetic predisposition, probably to salt sensitivity. And there have been some genes isolated as recently as earlier this year, which show an association specifically for high blood pressure in African Americans. But in addition to that, the more common causes are the increased prevalence of obesity, increased prevalence of stressors in African American lives, as well as access to healthcare. So all of these reasons probably are reasons why African Americans have a higher incidence of high blood pressure compared to whites. But we don't have one clear answer yet.
And obesity is a problem that is prevalent throughout all of American society. Some might say Western society, but it really seems to be here in North America and here in the United States in particular where there's a problem. Do we know why that is?
I think lifestyle reasons are definitely one of the major causes. People are more sedentary these days, lack of exercise, as well as, you know, the eating habits which have changed over the last several decades, leading to increased consumption of processed foods, less consumption of fruits and vegetables. All of these are definite reasons for increase in obesity. So even people who do not have a genetic predisposition to diabetes and high blood pressure are now developing these conditions. So clearly lifestyle changes are the biggest reason.
We know more, though, now. We know more about cholesterol. I mean, there were years ago, people would wake up and the automatic everyday breakfast was bacon and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
We know that today there's high sodium in bacon and that, you know, eggs without unless you reduce them to just the egg whites, they have a lot of cholesterol. So we have all this knowledge now. Why is it that we are not able to adjust accordingly?
Well, unfortunately, knowledge doesn't always translate to action, and you have to consider the psychosocial barriers, especially that African American face, with access to these kind of so-called healthy foods.
Psychosocial?
Yes, and mostly social determinants, where, you know, getting through the day itself is hard enough that where you have the time to actually shop for foods that are healthier than others, looking at food labels. I think one of the most important things in terms of patient education is educating patients how to read food labels, specifically with respect to sodium content. So people now know that looking at the cholesterol content of foods is important. Looking at, for example, saturated fat, trans fat, all of those things, I think thanks to media, people are aware of that. But it's as important to look at the sodium content of food or the salt content. Because the more healthy foods which are in the frozen section typically have a high content of sodium, because that's what keeps – that's the preservative that's used in those foods.
And a lot of those healthy choice, not to single out one particular,
yes.
but those are the ones oftentimes that are low in fat, but they also are high in sodium.
Right. And when you have a job to get to and you have kids to take care of and you're quickly trying to get a meal – that's typically what you go to, thinking that possibly this is healthy. But I think the sodium content of foods is something that we really need to educate the public about.
So that affects all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So looking now at African Americans in particular, why would African Americans in Allegheny County have higher death rates from heart disease than those in the rest of the state?
I wish we had a clear answer for that. I think one of the reasons we embarked on this study, which is called the Epidemiological Study of Cardiovascular Risk in African Americans, is to try to understand that. Is it access to healthcare? Is it social determinants? Is it genetic factors? Or is it a combination of all of those that actually lead to this eventual, you know, statistic, which obviously is not a good statistic?
Why is hypertension or high blood pressure called the silent killer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always talk to patients about this when they are first coming into the office, because unless you come into an office or at least go to a pharmacy or someplace to get your blood pressure checked, you really don't know what your blood pressure is. So,
well, wouldn't you be able to tell? I mean, isn't your heart rate going faster? Your heart beating harder? Wouldn't you be able to sense within yourself, boy, there's something going on here?
Well, you will be able to till when your blood pressure reaches about 200. But you obviously do not want to wait until then.
So you're in a danger zone well before that.
Absolutely.
And so there's really nothing that's that noticeable?
No, nothing at all. And that is exactly why it's called the silent killer. I think especially people who have a family history, who are obese, who have diabetes, those other risk factors especially need to have your blood pressure checked. I think everybody needs to have their blood pressure checked because, like I said, these days you do not necessarily need to have another family member who has high blood pressure for you to have that condition. So it's important for every adult. And, of course, even children these days are developing high blood pressure, especially as the incidence of childhood obesity has been increasing.
How much of it has to do with diet? And how much of it has to do with lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
I should say, how much of it has to do with diet and lifestyle, and how much of it has to do with genetics would be the better question.
Right. Most of the time, it's very hard to separate out these conditions. When we see patients who are lean, fit, eating a healthy diet, and yet have high blood pressure, we say more likely than not, this is genetics. But that's hard to come by, those kind of patients. So most patients have a combination of things. But when we do see high blood pressure, especially in younger and younger African Americans, we are starting to think that clearly there must be a genetic, and most of these are healthy, you know, people who are playing sports, et cetera, and who still develop high blood pressure. So then possibly the genetics are playing a bigger role.
We're talking with Dr. Indu Purnima of the West Penn Allegheny Health System. She is a cardiologist at Allegheny General Hospital, and she's here talking about the trend that shows that more African Americans in Allegheny County die from heart disease than those in the rest of the state. We're wondering why that is. How many Americans overall have hypertension, Dr. Purnima?
Like I said, it's about 30% among whites and about 40% among African Americans.
And out of that number,
this is the adult population.
Right. And how many of that, what percentage of those people do not know that they have high blood pressure?
Close to 60%.
60%. Right. Don't even realize it.
Correct. In our study of just 250 subjects enrolled so far, we know that the prevalence of high blood pressure, again, is close to 60%. This is just African Americans. And among the 60%, another 40% are currently being treated, but less than 10% is actually at goal for treatment of high blood pressure. So despite being diagnosed and despite being told that they have high blood pressure, and some of them are on medications, their blood pressure numbers are still not at goal. So there's a huge treatment gap as well as a diagnosis gap.
So what are some of the things that people can do to help themselves? There's some obvious things, but maybe some things that aren't so obvious.
Mm-hmm. I think the most obvious thing, of course, is to get your blood pressure checked. I think that would be a good start. And in addition to that, following up with your doctor. Unfortunately, especially among the African Americans and others as well, I commonly hear this, that I got started on medications. My doctor said my blood pressure is fine now. And so they just stopped their medications without understanding that this is a lifelong condition and you probably need to be on medications for the most part lifelong, except in conditions where if you were 100 pounds overweight, you lost a significant amount of weight. you've made a lot of lifestyle changes, then yes, there is a potential for you to get off medications. But the compliance with medical therapy, continued visits to the doctor, I think these are all conditions, important things for patients to remember.
Are pharmaceutical companies developing drugs specifically for African Americans to help treat high blood pressure?
Yeah, among drugs that are currently used for treatment of blood pressure, certainly there are certain groups of drugs that work better in African Americans compared to Caucasians as well as other ethnic populations, such as the diuretics or the water pills. So those specifically are better blood pressure medications in African Americans. There aren't any drugs being specifically targeted at this population, but I think there are certain therapies that work better.
Explain what preeclampsia is. Mm-hmm.
So women during pregnancy sometimes develop high blood pressure. More common in older pregnant women, women carrying who are multi-parents or carrying twins or triplets, etc., or women who have a genetic predisposition to high blood pressure. So all of these groups develop high blood pressure during their pregnancy. And as a result of that, they sometimes, the blood pressure actually damages the kidney and the women start leaking protein in the urine. So most women probably recall that when they're pregnant, their doctor checks their urine for protein. And if there's evidence of protein in the urine as well as high blood pressure during pregnancy, that condition is called preeclampsia. So preeclampsia is typically treated during pregnancy with certain medications. But the problem is these women actually have damage to their arterial walls even during that short period of hypertension that they have. So they're at risk for heart disease much later on in life. Most of the time, their blood pressure comes back to normal soon after the pregnancy or soon after the delivery. But 3 years from now, they may develop high blood pressure. So these are women who need to be very closely monitored for early diagnosis of hypertension.
How can the trends that we are seeing be reversed?
I think a major educational effort directed at both patients, physicians, patients for compliance to therapy, early diagnosis, lifestyle changes, physician or the medical community for better diagnosis, ensuring compliance with therapy, etc. And lastly, we have to find some innovative ways of tracking and making some changes in the social behavior of different populations. And that treatment needs to be geared, it needs to be socially compatible. I think that is what is also lacking. It needs to be more of a community effort. Maybe we need to involve people other than just the physician and the patient.
So that's what you mean when you say socially compatible?
Mm-hmm.
And who else would you involve?
Probably pharmacists, probably community social workers to ensure that patients are taking their medications, remaining compliant with therapy, etc. You know, there are studies ongoing looking at computerized algorithms or decision support tools using remote tracking devices to track blood pressure compliance as well as compliance with therapy. So using remote, smartphones, for example, and tracking patients' blood pressures on that.
We're talking with Dr. Indu Purnima, a cardiologist at Allegheny General Hospital. We are seeing the provisions of the Affordable Care Act kicking in. Regardless of how you phrase it, we're seeing a new era in public health care in the United States. How do you think that this will impact maybe more people getting screened for high blood pressure and hypertension and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. I think access to healthcare, as I referred to earlier, could be one of the major reasons why there's a higher prevalence of especially untreated hypertension in African Americans. So I'm hoping that as more people get access to healthcare through insurance, they will come in for their checkups and therefore get diagnosed with high blood pressure early on. In addition to that, it appears that the Affordable Care Act is going to insist on some major preventive measures being offered to patients in addition to drug therapy on a routine basis. So hopefully this would actually improve the problem.
So you're saying that for all of the debate about the Affordable Care Act and or Obamacare, that as far as you're concerned, there could be a very positive outcome from this, if for no other reason, seeing more people get screened or having access to health care.
Correct. And we know that in the last 20 years, the great strides that we've made in reduction of deaths from cardiovascular disease is primarily due to improvement in prevention efforts. So the better that becomes, hopefully we can make even more inroads into this.
Dr. Indu Purnima is a cardiologist at Allegheny General Hospital, and Dr. Purnima and the West Penn Allegheny Health System have begun a study to find out why hypertension and its complications are more prevalent in Black Americans than in other U.S. racial groups. Dr. Purnima, good luck with your work, and thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for having me.
Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Imagine being paralyzed from the neck down for nearly a decade, unable to do simple tasks like feeding yourself or filling in the blanks on a crossword puzzle. Then suddenly you're able to operate a robotic arm to move objects, shake hands, and feed yourself. And you can move that arm with your thoughts. That's what happened to Jan Sherman, a 53-year-old Whitehall woman who has participated in breakthrough research at UPMC. A robotic arm surgically attached to her brain allows her to perform basic tasks with focused thought. Jan is one of the first people to use this technology, and we spoke with her last January about her experience. We were also joined by University of Pittsburgh lead researcher Dr. Andrew Schwartz and Dr. Michael Boninger, a renowned researcher in spinal cord injury and assistive technology and director of the UPMC Rehabilitation Institute. We began our conversation by asking Dr. Schwartz how to study the brain.
Well, first of all, I'm a neurophysiologist, and the way we study the brain is by recording from individual neurons. And this goes back, it was really a hot topic back in the 50s and the 60s. And the way this was accomplished was by introducing microelectrodes. These are basically very small little needles. Into the brain and recording from these neurons. And neurons communicate with each other by firing pulses of electricity. And so if you were to listen to the recordings that you get from these little needles, it would sound like a Geiger counter. And so, for instance, because these neurons are so small and the tips of the electrodes are so small, in the 50s and 60s, the animals were asleep when you did this. And so imagine that you had a sleeping animal and you're recording from one of these neurons and you pinch the animal's finger. Say it was a monkey. And what you would do then is if you heard this neuron fire when you pinched the finger, you would automatically assume that the neuron was receiving input from that finger. And so that was sort of the, you know, you make that sort of logical jump. Now, for those of us that were interested in the way the brain controls movement, this was much more difficult because the animal was asleep and it wouldn't move. And so all the work that was done until this point was basically stimulating the brain and then looking to see if muscles would twitch, for instance. So it was basically an anatomy experiment. But in the 60s and the 70s, Ed Evarts at NIH developed a method in which you could record from awake monkeys. And so what he did is he recorded from a part of the brain called the motor cortex, and he had trained animals to just simply move their wrist back and forth, flex and extend their wrist. And he saw that in a certain part of the brain, these neurons would fire. And so again, the logical conclusion was that these neurons related to flexion and extension of the wrist or therefore muscle activity. And then a few years later at Johns Hopkins, this was extended further. So now animals, instead of just simply moving their wrist back and forth, they could actually reach and use their hand in a natural way. And this was done by Apostolos Georgopoulos. And what he found was that even these natural movements, you could find a very nice relationship between the way these neurons fired and natural movement. So in other words, these neurons seem to be related more to the structure of the movement than to the anatomy of the movement. And right about that time, I joined his lab. I was very interested in this overall structure of movement. When we talk about structure of movement, think about dancers and the beautiful way that dancers move. And actually, that extends to all natural movements. If you just look at simple reaching movements, there's a certain beauty and coordination and smoothness and precision in those movements. And I was very interested in that. Well, long story short, it turned out that working with Georgopoulos at Hopkins, we found that there was a very nice representation of these beautiful structure of the movements in this region of the brain called motor cortex. And we developed a way to extract those signals with a very good precision by looking at populations of neurons. It turned out you needed to record from many neurons simultaneously to get this signal. And, you know, later on my own, I extended this to drawing movements, and we saw that we could extract, for instance, the shape that you're drawing from this signal. And therefore, if you were signing your name, we could recognize that in your brain activity. And at that point, we realized that this would be a very nice tool for capturing intended movements from people who couldn't move their own arms, so that we could capture these movements and then generate the desired movements for these people who were paralyzed.
Jan Sherman, you suffer from spinocerebellar degeneration.
That's right.
Before the paralysis set in, describe what your life was like.
So before the paralysis, I was living in Lancaster, California, with my husband and our two children, who were 6 and 4 when I became ill. I worked from home. I ran a murder mystery party business. I had written my first book and was looking for a publisher, and worked in the evenings and while the kids were at school, was home for them during the day when they were. I was very happy, very content, and always very healthy. I went to neurologists. I went to the University of Southern California. No one knew what was wrong. I had surgery to move a disc in my neck. They thought the spinal cord may have been compressed. Within 2 years, I went from being perfectly healthy to needing a motorized wheelchair that I could drive with my right hand, which was the only limb I had left working. At that time, I moved back to Pittsburgh to be with family.
What was your reaction when you first heard about this new type of surgery?
Well, I saw a video a friend sent me on my email of a man named Tim Hems, who was doing this movement of the robotic arm with his mind. And when I saw him come off the elevator in his chair, he uses an elongated chair like I do, which he drives with head movements. Then it was the first time I've actually seen someone in a chair like mine. And when I saw what he was doing, my first reaction was, oh, wow, that's so cool that he can do that. Then my second reaction was, I want to do that. So as soon as the video was over and they had a phone call number for volunteers, I had my attendant dial it, and I called and I said, are you the guys who did that with Tim Hems? Well, I'm a quadriplegic. I want to do that. Where do I sign up? So they didn't even have to come looking for me. I saw that, and I knew I wanted to do it right away.
So you knew you wanted to do this, but, of course, there was some risk involved. And Dr. Schwartz, what are the dangers that go along with this type of surgery?
Well, it's real neurosurgery, and you have to open up the skull, and you have to open up the outer layer of the brain, which is called the dura, and then insert these electrodes. The electrodes themselves are relatively short. They're just 1.5 millimeters. It's shorter than a thumbtack, and they go in the very outermost of the brain. And the immediate concerns in any kind of surgery like this is bleeding. It turns out when you do the risk assessment, the most dangerous part is the connector that comes through the skin on top of Jan's head. That's a site for potential infection. And that's the part that's the riskiest, and that's easily handled by just keeping everything really clean and just taking care of that site.
Jan, I know you really wanted this surgery. Were you concerned at all about the risks that you were taking?
No, because they were explained to me, and I understand there are also the same risks as with any surgery. But the fact that it had been done already with Mr. Hems made me not fear it at all. To my mind, it had already been done. It was successful. So, of course, mine would be successful as well. I mean, I considered the risks. I considered it absolutely worth it to undergo those risks for the benefit.
Describe what it's like, Jan, to suddenly have this ability after 10 years of not being able to do it, to suddenly have the ability to control a robotic arm with just your thoughts.
It was amazing. It was so cool that the first day I was moving the arm in different directions. And by the end of the second day, I was able to high-five Dr. Schwartz. There's no way to describe it other than amazing, the power I felt by being able to move something, the thrill it was to do something I hadn't done for 10 years. They couldn't wipe the smile off my face. I was just grinning all day.
What kind of training and mental effort does this require?
Well, doing each task the first time, it takes a lot of concentration. But then after I get it, it's just a matter of practicing it till it becomes second nature, and I do it without thinking about it. You know, moving the arm up and down at first, I had to concentrate a lot. But as soon as I understood the movement and had done it several times, it became second nature. Until to move the arm up now, I don't do anything more than you do. I look at where I want to move it, and it goes.
Dr. Boninger, what has this taught you about the brain?
I think that it's what it's taught me about the brain is the amazing adaptability of the brain, the amazing capacity it has for learning and adapting to the situation, and then for, you know, I think based on Andy's work, our then ability to tap into that learning and our ability to tap into the information that's present in the brain to make a real impact.
How big a breakthrough is this?
Well, this is a huge breakthrough. I think that previous research has shown really what I would call a relatively limited ability to control a prosthetic through thought. I think the fact that the team was able to do it this quickly and with this many degrees of freedom, with 7 degrees of freedom and the potential for even more, really opens up a world of possibilities for control, being able to control a prosthetic, or even to help with rehabilitation.
How far along is this technology, gentlemen? Are things like robotic legs in the works, for example?
You know, that there are robotic legs that are out there. Control of a robotic leg for the task of walking is actually a simpler exercise than what we've done with the upper limb with Jan. So in the area of prosthetics, there's all types of motorized prosthetics being developed. The what makes this project unique, I think, is the ability to work with the hand, which is really, I think, from a musculoskeletal and control perspective, the most complex structure that we use as humans to interact with our environment. And so in some ways, I think we're tackling the most complex area. I think as this technology advances, we'd be able to expand it and look at other areas like walking, ambulation, and prosthetics related to the legs.
Dr. Schwartz?
Well, I think Mike Mix is exactly right. But it turns out that in terms of safety, for instance, because we walk on two legs, if you make a mistake in your prosthetic control and someone stumbles, there's a lot bigger consequence than if they miss a little bit with their hand when they're reaching for a target. So in some ways, it's more challenging. And I should also point out that there are other labs that are working on prosthetic locomotion.
Now, this whole University of Pittsburgh initiative and research that you are both intricately involved with is part of a military initiative to fast-track the development of robotic prosthesis in response to some 1,300 soldiers who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan missing limbs. What can you tell us about this?
Well, that was the initial impetus to get the project started. I think it's grown beyond that now. And we recently had the head of DARPA come and visit Pittsburgh. And he made a point that really the DARPA's mission is to advance the basic science power of the country. And so I think that in that regard, this is a better example of something in that category.
What other breakthroughs do you think that there will be, Dr. Boninger?
What other breakthroughs that impact people with amputations?
Yes.
Well, you know, let me take a step back from the amputation. You know, Jan does not have an amputation,
right,
the subject in this, and neither did Tim. And so I think that one of the fantastic things about this technology is that it can have an impact for people like Jan and Tim. So it doesn't have to be constrained to people with amputation. And Andy and I have talked about how it could be applicable in individuals with strokes and muscular dystrophy and a number of disabilities that affect the brain or affect the brain's ability to communicate with other structures, as is the case with Jan. You know, I think that in the rehabilitation realm, I'd go past the realm that is just prosthetics, because I think we've covered that pretty well. In prosthetics, I think we're going to continue to see more advanced limbs and better ways to control them. And I think one place that we need to go to is also better ways to get sensation back from the limb. So we need to get to a point where not only is Jan capable of moving a limb through thought, but she's able to sense what the arm is touching, just like you and I would do. In terms of, you know, rehabilitation in general for amputations or these conditions, I think there'll be breakthroughs. There'll be breakthroughs in exoskeletons, so devices that you could wear, someone like Jan could wear, that will get stronger. And if she can control them, then would enable her to help move her own arms as opposed to a robotic arm. I think that we'll see advances in robotics that help with the rehabilitation, not just with replacing the function. So this prosthetic limb that Jan is using would replace a limb. I also think for someone who's had a stroke, there have been, and we have examples of some, you know, high-end equipment at the Rehab Institute, that robotic arms, exoskeletons that enable someone to move their own arm through space, assist them with it as they're going through rehab so that they have greater recovery. And there's research in stem cells, all of which I think is actually going on in Pittsburgh, which makes this an amazing place to be. And so I think there's breakthroughs on the horizon in many of these areas.
I also have a question about the potential implications for athletes. We saw famously in the Olympics just this past summer, an athlete with prosthetic legs participating at a level with able-bodied athletes. What about that potential, gentlemen?
You know, I think that we're I think that over time we hope to achieve a level of control with this technology that rivals that which an able-bodied person, someone without disability, control a hand. But we're a ways away from that. We're certainly closer than we've been in the past. I think that when you take the average person and then you compare that to an elite athletic level, I can't envision a future where this type of neuroprosthetic for motor control would surpass the innate wiring of the human body. I think we're light years from that that scenario.
Dr. Schwartz?
Well, you know, there is, again, getting in the realm of science fiction, people are talking about this area called enhancement. And, you know, a lot of futurists like to talk about that. But, again, as Dr. Bonger was saying, I think that's beyond the realm of what we're talking about here.
One last question. This is an off-air question from an anonymous caller who has a child with cerebral palsy and wants to know how this could help people with that condition.
You know, as we've been looking for volunteers for this research, we've had a few people with cerebral palsy, both children and adults, who've been interested in this. And I think there's tremendous potential in that realm for there to be for this to work. I think that one of the fundamental problems with cerebral palsy is that connection between the a person's thought to move and their ability to move. And that this down the road, I think both of us would have as a goal that would be a population that we would attempt to implant and attempt to use this technology to help.
Dr. Schwartz, any final thoughts?
Well, you know, the thing that is amazing is you're seeing basically the outcome of years of research. And what this really shows is just the tip of the iceberg of what we're beginning to learn on a scientific basis about the way the brain works. And so I think not only are you seeing this translational research come to fruition, but you should be well aware that there's a lot of basic research going on that are going to make a lot of new discoveries about brain function in the near future.
Well, I want to thank both of you for participating in a fascinating discussion. University of Pittsburgh lead researcher, Professor Andrew Schwartz, and joining us by phone, Dr. Michael Boninger with the UPMC Rehabilitation Institute. He's the director of the UPMC Rehabilitation Institute, joining us by phone. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Congratulations on the success of your research and the continuation of it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you again.
Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheim. A New York Times opinion piece by actress Angelina Jolie disclosed her decision to have a double mastectomy after learning she carries a mutation of a gene that increased her risk of breast cancer. Dr. Lawrence Wickerham, director of the Division of Cancer Genetics at Allegheny General Hospital, published a study in June that detailed new research regarding the genetics of the cancer. We first asked him to tell us about his research and what it would mean for the prevention and treatment of breast cancer.
Well, you mentioned Angelina Jolie. There is about 230,000 invasive breast cancers that will occur in the United States this year. The inherited risk that she has represents maybe 5 to 10% of those women. The other 90 or 95% of women that develop breast cancer have risk factors, the biggest risk factor being a woman. Any woman is at risk for this disease. But we know that there are other women among those women at higher risk based on family history or other risk factors in their own individual medical history. And we've been focusing, the research group that I work for, focusing on trying to prevent the disease in those broad-based group of women. And we've been successful at it. Over the past 20 years, we've done two large prevention trials, entering over 33,000 healthy women at increased risk for the future development of breast cancer, and have shown that these two drugs can reduce that risk by over 50%. When these women entered the study, we asked them to donate a tube of blood, and we used some of that blood to identify DNA that will allow us to better identify women who could benefit from the drugs, making that 50% benefit maybe 70, 80, 90, trying to get up to 100% benefit. This is preliminary stuff, but we think it will allow us to begin to make breast cancer a truly preventable disease.
And as I understand it, many of the women who took part in this study, if not all of them, did so without knowing or receiving any kind of guarantee that this research would directly benefit them.
Correct. These were women that volunteered for the study. They knew what they were getting into, but also recognized that it might not be of immediate benefit to them themselves. They had seen family members with this disease. They wanted to try to improve the care of breast cancer for their children and their grandchildren, and for the children of women they were never going to meet. And they succeeded in doing that.
And what kind of risks were they taking?
Not huge risks. The quality of care that they received was top-notch. These studies are carefully monitored over time. But like any medicine, there were potential side effects and toxicities. We kept those to the bare minimum, I assure you. But nonetheless, they didn't know that they were going to benefit themselves, but they were willing to take those risks on.
An article on this study, Dr. Wickerham, mentioned the drugs. Tamoxifen and raloxifene. Are these the leading drugs used in the treatment of breast cancer?
Tamoxifen remains the most commonly prescribed breast cancer drug in the world. It's a pill. You take it once a day for a 5 or 10 year period. Highly effective. And what we found was the women taking tamoxifen to prevent recurrence of their original breast cancer had far fewer new cancers of the opposite breast. That's why we began to use it in healthy individuals. Raloxifene, chemically very similar. The commercial name is Evista. It's been used now for almost 20 years in the United States to treat and prevent osteoporosis. Hmm. And there, too, women helping their bones had fewer breast cancers. So we have compared these two over time and find them to be both highly effective. Evista is only used in postmenopausal women, but if you've got a need to help maintain your bone strength and also have a family history of breast cancer, Evista is a pretty darn good choice to consider. You get a 2-for-1 benefit.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer among American women. And so due to this prevalence, is it easier to find people to volunteer for these studies because they know the good that can come from them?
The public awareness about breast cancer does make it a little bit easier. We do studies in other diseases that don't benefit from that level of public awareness. There's always some concerns about research studies. The guinea pig issues come into a factor, but the quality of care and the information we give patients makes it a very reasonable choice. Not everybody who's a candidate for a research study chooses to enter them, but they should indeed seek them out if they are in these categories.
In addition to your research, do you know of any other advances that are being made regarding breast cancer, such as less invasive surgical procedures?
Right. The research group that I work for over time has been responsible for a lot of that change. When I began medical school, the treatment of breast cancer was simple. Everybody had a true radical mastectomy, was told to go home and come back if you have any problems. Now, due to research studies headquartered here in Pittsburgh, we don't do radical mastectomies anymore. Lumpectomies are the standard of care, and we're looking at ways to potentially eliminate the need for breast surgery altogether.
I understand that one of the more recent developments is regarding the removal of lymph nodes.
Yes.
And in many cases, it's being done in a way that fewer lymph nodes are removed.
Correct. In the past, we removed literally every lymph node in the patient's armpit.
And that was because?
We did it for two reasons. We wanted to remove the potential cancer that might be in those lymph nodes, and we wanted to see how many lymph nodes were involved with the cancer cells. That told us the prognosis of the patients. Now we're able to select one or two nodes, get the information we need, and avoid the side effects and toxicities of removing all those nodes.
And so now people who undergo this treatment or have lymph nodes removed, their recovery can be that much faster?
Yes. Often the lymph node surgery was more of a problem postoperatively than the breast itself. They're able to get back into normal activity far faster. The swelling of the arm that can come from removing all the lymph nodes still occurs, but it's a very rare side effect, luckily.
Dr. Wickerham, did you have a good representation of ethnic groups participating in your research?
We try very hard to make that happen. African-American women represented about 6 to 8% of the women in these prevention trials. We would like to have done better. We had a lot of outreach activities. There's a variety of issues that can make that difficult. Some of them are societal. Some of them are pure economics. I'm not sure we did a real good job of entering poor white women in this study as well. But we recognize that it can be an issue. We want women in these studies to represent women in general in the public so that the results can also be applied to the general public.
And do we see a greater incidence of breast cancer in minorities?
No, we don't actually. The incidence rate of breast cancers is actually lower in most African American women. The problem is that their death rate from breast cancer is higher than white women. And that's for a variety of reasons. Some of them are simple economics. Their access to care may not be as good. The care that they can access may not be equivalent to that of white women. So that, too, is a factor. There is some biology. The cancers that can occur in African American women have a higher percentage of more aggressive cancers. So that too can be a factor.
So if you had your choice, most people, male or female, if you have any kind of cancer at all, you'd like to have access to a place like the Mayo Clinic or a place that gives you the best treatment possible. How much closer are we with some of the revisions that we're seeing in healthcare to where there's more equal access? You would think that as people are battling diseases as serious as cancer or AIDS or whatever it may be, that it would be an imperative to get the kind of care to anybody that needs it, regardless of their economic status or their race, gender, whatever.
Right. There's a variety of issues here that hopefully with the Obamacare changes, I know there's a lot of concerns and anxieties about Obamacare, but the ability to get high-quality cancer care may actually be dramatically improved under some of these new provisions. We also have some advantages here in Western Pennsylvania that your listeners should be aware of. One of the barriers is getting a mammogram. And if you don't have insurance or you're not well insured, you may not want to be spending your money, or at least think that you should be spending your money on mammograms. Luckily, here in Western Pennsylvania, the Race for the Cure on Mother's Day each day raises funds that fund a mammogram voucher program. Any woman in Western Pennsylvania can get a mammogram at basically no cost. This is administered by Adagio Health. They have an 800 number that I'll be happy to give your listeners in a moment, where they can call, get a voucher, and get the mammogram that they need. You get the voucher in advance of your mammogram appointment, and it's a done deal.
And when it comes to a woman making it a point to get a mammogram, all of these early detection devices, I would think, aside from saving lives, would also provide a benefit economically, because if you detect these things early, you're going to have that much less of a need for treatment.
That you're absolutely correct. Both the treatment costs and the ability to get back to work and back to family responsibilities more rapidly has been a real plus. But it does involve finding the cancers at a physically small size at an early stage where prognosis is better. It's not 100%. We still have, unfortunately, far too many women die from this disease, but the death rates have been coming down now for several decades.
According to the American Cancer Society website, breast cancer deaths have been declining since 1989. Do you think this is due to earlier detection or better treatment?
I think it's due to both, and probably some other lifestyle issues, that Americans are simply healthier and more health conscious. But we need to remain on top of that.
Do you think a cure for this disease is within reach?
We're making incredible strides. We're no longer treating breast cancers, we're treating molecular subtypes of breast cancer. And what we're going to find is that a molecular subtype may only be 5% or 10% of a cancer each year, but we'll have treatments that can cure that subtype. And we'll march along to the point where it doesn't become a curable disease. Prevention is an important part of that. We know over the history of medicine tells us, but often the biggest advances are made through prevention, not through treatment. So we're working at both sides of the equation.
And we started this conversation by talking about Angelina Jolie. And for some, the preventative measure that she took by deciding that she was going to have the double mastectomy, do you find people asking about why she didn't wait, why she did something that in the view of some might have been radical to do it so soon?
Well, it did raise public awareness of the issue, and I think that's good, much as Betty Ford and Happy Rockefeller in the 70s raised the awareness of the disease. Now prevention of breast cancer may benefit from these discussions. She's made choices that others may not choose to make, but the visibility of it has been an overall plus. I think it was a courageous move on her part to make it public. Forget the choices that she made. She didn't have to make it apparent that she was going through this herself. She's to be congratulated for that piece.
Our guest has been Dr. Lawrence Wickerham, Director of the Division of Cancer Genetics at Allegheny General Hospital. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. We welcome your comments and story ideas at esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can catch the entire show at wesa.fm or as a podcast. This is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR station. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening.